Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com. Today is podcast number 65. This is for Friday, December 16th, 2011. Ben and Kai, this was previously recorded, and so I'll just turn you right over to the previous recording.
So we're going to talk about raising a non-aggressive family, mm-hmm. or at least that's going to be the first part
right.
of what we're talking about.
And then later is...
Mature, responsible relationships, how at some point we're going to be talking about parent-child relationships once everybody's at in adulthood, including sibling relationships once the siblings are adulthood, and eventually, whether we get to it in this podcast or not, eventually we're going to be talking about old age. Mm-hmm. And the proper what real responsibilities are as far as when a parent or a sibling becomes elderly mm-hmm. and can't take on their own can't handle their own situation. You have a thought?
Well, yeah. I want to make sure and point out that governments and like other things. A family unit is a voluntary
right.
community as yeah. well.
If it's based on aggression, mm-hmm. then it's imbalanced. Mm-hmm. There's something not right about it. And the fact that that the size or the age, whether young or old, of any particular individual, mm-hmm. if the relationship is based on violence, based on aggression...
And it's not an arbitrary age. I mean, if you're 15 and mm-hmm. you're... emotionally and physically mature enough to leave an abusive relationship with your family, mm-hmm. then
you should.
You should.
And this is a problem in modern, in the United States today, is that when you have a 15-year-old that's in an abusive family, that 15-year-old has, because of the state, mm-hmm. that 15-year-old's choices are... polluted? What's the right word? Perverted?
Highly controlled.
Yeah, because what does the state say? Well, the state says either you have to stay in that situation, mm-hmm. or if you try to escape and obtain freedom from that situation, we will grab you and throw you in a cage, or we'll throw you into a state-authorized family that may very likely be just as abusive as your original mm-hmm. abusive family.
Or... maybe not. Maybe it's a great family, but the fact of the matter is, you're emotionally an adult.
Yeah, and on top of that, is it where you would have naturally chosen, right. or is it someplace that you're assigned?
Right.
Because central planning, whether it's in the economy, or whether it's how many, pounds of butter are produced, or how many eggs are produced, or how many shoelaces are produced, or where children are raised, central authority, central planning... is a failure. It always fails.
So, we'll get into that.
Yeah. And that's not the topic at the moment.
But we'll begin with...
Okay.
We begin at the beginning.
The other thing that I hope to introduce in this particular podcast is something that we haven't been doing. Now that we're on the Liberty Radio Network, we need to occasionally let listeners know that this is BadQuaker.com podcast. Mm-hmm. And because people who are just tuning in on the radio may just hear people babbling and not have any idea who it is.
And spend an hour searching through
yeah.
trying to figure out who they're listening to at the moment.
So, and the other thing I don't want to do is what I just did a second ago, which is to say who we are so fast that someone who doesn't know the name won't be
able to...
I don't know, it's some kind of... but yes, it's Bad Quaker. .com, having nothing to do with cookies. Yes. And now somebody's saying badcookies.com.
Bad cookie? Wait, Quaker cookies? I want a cookie. Are we recording?
We are.
Oh, okay.
No, not at all. We're totally casually not recording. So, so let's start with the youngest ages. Now, we could get all wrapped up in when does life start and what rights exist at what point, but rather than just completely bogging ourselves down in
right.
rhetorical arguments, let's go to something that we can put you know, the real meat and potatoes of the thing. When a child is born, and you're looking at that little big-headed, bald, toothless thing,
little monster-looking creature.
As helpless as it is a full human. Mm-hmm. It has all the rights of any other human, mm-hmm. and it should be treated as such. Mm-hmm. Technically speaking, you could say that a mother has no obligation to the child. Father has no obligation to the child, mm-hmm. other than the fact that through their activity, the child exists.
Right.
Therefore, out of human kindness, they should, you know, do what they can to ensure that the child is okay.
Right.
And that's in one reason, or in one sense, that's why babies of most mammals are so cute, I think. Because whether you're talking about a human baby or a puppy or a kitten or, you know, most any mammal.
It's an interesting thing that isn't really on the topic, but it is in regards to the state with the human physiology. What happens when a mother gives birth, mm-hmm. it releases these chemicals that are highly powerful and makes the mother, it kicks into this mother brain mm-hmm. that makes her fiercely protective of that baby. And in, you know, a lot of state sponsored, the cesarean section rate in mm-hmm. this country is at like 30%.
Mm-hmm.
And the World Health Organization recommends like, you know, 10.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's,
well, because in our fascist society, it's very lucrative mm-hmm. for a hospital or for a doctor to not take a chance.
Yep.
Because if they take a chance on not doing a cesarean when anything at all says maybe a cesarean is the way to go, if they take that chance, they are risking certain liabilities.
Yep.
And this is all because of the fascist process we have in regards to the insurance that doctors have to have, the layers and layers and layers of insurance brought on by the entire legal profession being so deeply embedded in the government mm-hmm. that, you know, that they distort the free market in the medical profession.
And you have, you know, the medical profession itself is governed by these regulating bodies that are not necessarily actual up to date with the most important information.
Right.
You know, they're not based on that. They're based on making money.
Right. Exactly.
And funding their organizations.
Yeah, and for a hospital, let's just say, or a doctor even, to be in it to make money, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that.
Right.
But it's when you get secondary agencies and
lobbyists.
And organizations that say this is an acceptable hospital and that's not an acceptable hospital, and government money going to support this hospital or that doctor.
And, you know, funding medication usage.
Right. And the pharmaceutical companies getting all their talents
involved.
And that's
part of the thing. What happens is, you know, a woman goes into the hospital and a labor, especially a first labor, can last days.
Yeah.
And the hospital really doesn't like for you to be sitting in their bed for more than a couple of hours.
Right.
So it goes 10, 12 hours, and they go, well, you're taking too long. We need to induce you.
Yeah.
So they give you Pitocin,
mm-hmm.
which is a synthetic version of oxytocin, which is what you're body produces naturally, but they give you this artificial version, and it makes you have really strong labor,
contractions
which is really painful. So then you get an epidural, and because you have an epidural, it slows the labor down. So they give you more Pitocin, and that, and because of all of these, and they're laying you flat on your back, mm-hmm. which is the most ridiculous position to give birth in ever.
It's funny because, I don't mean to be crude. It's not my point. But people don't go to the bathroom laying on their back.
No. You know, it's super convenient for the doctor
mm-hmm.
because, you know,
yeah.
they can sit on the little stool.
Hey, it's and we're like working on a 57 Plymouth or something. You know, you just put it on the rack and walk around it. And,
yeah,
you know.
But it's it's a terrible position for a person to give birth in. You don't go to any society where they don't have these and people are giving birth standing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, hey, we have something called gravity here on this planet.
Yeah. Now, and what you were alluding at a second ago is once you get this mother drugged to a certain position, to a certain point, and possibly even in the midst of a cesarean, and maybe she's got a spinal block going on, or maybe she's pumped full of different drugs or whatever, what you've actually done is retard her natural ability to what's the word I'm looking for, where when a new thing is born, the first thing it sees...
it imprints.
Imprints, yeah. So what you're actually doing is you're retarding the ability of the mother to imprint onto the baby when it's being born.
And then, you know, you go through all of this, and every intervention that you have makes it more likely you're going to have a cesarean.
Yeah.
And so eventually you get to the point where that is what happens. Mm. And so if you have a cesarean instead of a natural labor, you don't have any, and especially if you're given Pitocin, because if you're given Pitocin, your body goes, oh, we've got that. We don't need to make that.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make any oxytocin.
Now let's
which means you don't bond with your child because you don't have that, you know, that hormonal cocktail of this is my baby. I'll kill anyone who touches it.
Now, we should give a disclaimer at this point, because we've gotten in trouble on topics like this before.
Yes.
As we're speaking, because we're saying that, you know, A is the very, very best ever, A is what we really, really want, that doesn't mean that anybody who partakes of B is a horrible human being and should be stoned to death at the edge of the village.
No.
Well, there are many circumstances where a cesarean brings life to both the mother and the child, and without it, they would die.
And thank goodness we have the ability to do that.
Sure, exactly. And
it's just that we don't need to do it 30% of the time.
Yeah. The fascist process that we have that manipulates the market in childbirth distorts it. And so we don't know what should be. We don't really know what the number should be of cesareans, because there is no true free market in medicine.
And it's interesting, because if you look at the people who are doing home births, midwives, on average, they have about a 7% rate of transfer to the hospital in cesarean section. So on average, that's about where emergencies need to be. But because you hear so many people say, well, I had a cesarean, and you know, if I hadn't have, I would have lost the baby. Well, what happened prior to that? You know, was it a breech baby? Was there complications before you went into the hospital?
Yeah.
Did you have interventions done at the hospital? Because the majority of the time, if your doctor says to you, you know, if we hadn't had the cesarean, we would have lost your baby, it's because they've done something else to make that situation happen.
Yeah, and keeping in mind, the doctor's not going to come out of the whole process and say, well, we did the cesarean, we probably didn't have to, but I wanted to because my insurance rate is right now at this, and I really don't want it to turn into that. A doctor's not going to tell you that.
Yeah, and, so, you know, it's... when you look at the statistics, and it clearly shows that there are more cesareans that happen on a Friday afternoon and around the holidays.
Yeah.
Well, come on. Really?
And here's another thing, going back to the free market argument. If we had a true free market, then you wouldn't have only doctors in this magic guild that's authorized by the AMA having access to certain medications and certain procedures and certain things. So if, for instance, if the market were allowed to be free, and we really knew what the market preferred in all these things, then perhaps certain midwives would have developed certain techniques mm-hmm. that where they could use modern medicine rather than being, you know, we have right now we have this wall of separation between the midwives that are still functioning in the 1800s and modern doctors who have all the technology.
Yeah.
But if that wall of separation weren't there, forced by the state.
And even the midwives who have access to things like Pitocin and mm-hmm. Dopplers and things like that, they have to be certified by the state in order to be given permission to have those things.
Mm-hmm. So we still have the pollution of all the aggression that comes with the state.
Yep. So, in a perfectly free market, I would be able to say, you know what, I want to go to the hospital to have a baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's fine. Mm-hmm. Or I could say I want to go to a birthing center, or I could say I want to stay in my home.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't be burdened by certain, you know, oh, my insurance doesn't
yeah.
accept anything other than a hospital birth.
Right.
You know?
Who knows? There could be drive-up birthing centers. 30 minutes or less. We'll come right to your home. We'll deliver that baby in 30 minutes or less, or you get a coupon, you get a coupon for your next baby. But okay. So all these things work in conjunction to, at least interrupt some of that connection of the first moments when a baby is born, when it's first making its very first impressions of the earth, and the mother who's making her very first impressions of the baby.
And I kind of feel like that violates the non-aggression principle when you have, and I hate to sound this way, I really do, but when you have this male doctor who comes in
mm-hmm.
and, you know,
you hate the men, huh? You hate the men, huh?
Delivers
you want us all dead? Is that what it is?
You know, pulls the baby aside and wipes down the baby mm-hmm. and, you know, sends it off to the nursery. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether you like it or not, this system was mm-hmm. put in place by male doctors.
Not only that, and let's get a little bit nastier.
Prior to that,
the system we have of, I mean, the proper everything as far as the whole birthing routine, if it were done exactly the way that the doctors and the hospitals traditionally, and I'm saying traditionally,
right.
we're only talking the last 100 years.
Right.
This is a process that was pretty much invented around 1900 by a bunch of progressive doctors who were also supporting things like euthanasia mm-hmm. and...
And the nasty hate that they put out against midwives.
Yeah.
They showed midwives as, you know...
Witch-like and
witch-like and almost and always mm-hmm. from a strong ethnic background.
Yeah, that was part of the smear campaign mm-hmm. to get people to accept the modern mm-hmm. birthing process around 1900.
Because prior to that, it was female-oriented. Because
yeah.
hey, guess what? Only females can do it.
Yeah. Now, when these, and I'm calling them progressives because that's who this was in the early 1900s that put this through. When they institutionalized this process, it could have been a Henry Ford type.
Oh, yeah.
He could have sat down and said, well, first thing we got to do is get an assembly line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was that type of mentality, which works great if you're making Model Ts.
Right.
But it's not so great if you're bringing humans into the world.
Right.
So the old process, literally, as a baby was born, it went straight to the bosom of the mother, and mm-hmm. she could look at it eye to eye,
yep.
and it was right laying right there inches away from her face, and the baby was able to focus on the mother,
yep.
and there was...
Because the thing is, that's a huge shock to go from being in the womb to out in the, you know...
Yeah.
So, and the way that humans developed,
mm-hmm.
we developed to have a very slow maturation?
yeah.
Maturing period.
Right.
You know,
right.
there are some animals who
are born and they're ready to run.
And there they go. They're
yeah.
off.
Yep.
But we're not. We're a carrying,
mm-hmm.
you know, and whether you believe in evolution or not, it's the same thing with, you know, chimpanzees and apes and all that.
Yeah.
That's a carrying. And kangaroos and
mm-hmm.
that aspect of animals
mm-hmm.
is that child has to be right next to the mother so it can regulate its heartbeat, so it can regulate its breathing, so it can regulate its body temperature.
Actually, let's compare humans to, well, let's compare mammals to marsupials, because marsupials, when their little critter is born, that is an ugly little worm-like looking thing. It's a hairless, bald, ugly, big-headed, nasty-looking little thing that looks like it needs to be wiped off in the dirt. And it, on its own, crawls into the pouch. And sometimes the mother will lick around on it or whatever, but essentially you have this tiny little thing that's only, you know, it's maybe not much bigger than a bean, and it crawls up and goes into the pouch, and then the mother doesn't see it again until the time that it finally emerges, and it's cute.
Right.
Whereas most mammals, when they're born, whether, like I said a second ago, a kitten, a puppy, a baby monkey, a human, name another, you know, most of these things, even ugly little baby squirrels, are cute.
Even things that are not cute when they grow up, like, you know, possums.
Yeah.
Well, possums are possums marsupials?
Possums are marsupials.
Okay.
Yeah. But they're also in an ugly, twisted, cute, kind of a weird way. But raccoons, or even the if you go into the rodent area. Oops. That would be volume on the computer.
Sorry, folks.
So anyway, so the little cute things drive the adults to desire to take care of them, drive the adults to have a desire to play with them and hold them and hug them and rub their faces and things.
Yep.
And all that creates a bonding, and it's an exchange. It's a give and take. The baby likes to be held, likes to be nurtured, likes to have its face rubbed, likes to be kissed, likes to have eye contact back and forth. And the mother, or the father even, gets something back out of that.
Right.
You get a certain joy out of holding the baby, out of looking at the baby in the eye. So it's a give and take. It's an exchange.
Right.
There's a market there.
Right.
So each of them gets something from this exchange.
And I kind of feel like it is, you know, it's a basic human right to do everything possible to have a birth that is conducive to that. And I feel like when you take that away, for a reason other than you are going to die if we don't do this, is kind of violating their basic rights, you know? Because that takes away that ability to have that initial bonding. And, you know, it can be formed later.
Yeah.
But it's never going to be the same if it, you know, if that start is not right.
Well, I've often, this is a metaphor that you can compare to the family or to individuals or to individual relationships, or it's a very flexible metaphor. So I like to use it a lot. I used to use it more than I do now, but anyway, so I'm going to use the metaphor now. The metaphor that I'm going to use is a metaphor that I've often used.
Smack.
That's how it goes at badquaker.com. So this is the badquaker.com podcast that I'm warning you about, folks. There's always a certain level of insanity involved here. Anyway, so my metaphor that I was going to make a metaphor about. This is a automobile. You look at something and you say, is this an automobile? And if you answer that question, yes, then you ask the question, would I drive this automobile on a highway? The next question is, would I take this on a coast-to-coast trip? Would I trust my life in this automobile to take off on a 3,000-mile journey? And as you look at these series of questions, and if you answer yes or no to each one, then you can come to the conclusion of whether you have the type of an automobile that is the ultimate good automobile or something that's less than that. Okay, so if you take that automobile and you answer, is this an automobile? And you answer, yes, this is an automobile. Would I take this on the freeway? No. Is this automobile drivable at all? No. Is this automobile currently in a junkyard? Yes. Has this automobile been compacted and crushed into a cube the size of your foot? Yes. Is this an automobile? Yes, it is still an automobile.
Right.
It's just not functional. And in between that crushed automobile that is not functional and that one that you're willing to drive coast to coast that you're more than comfortable to get in and put 3,000 miles behind, there is a sea of variations between those things.
Right.
So when we're talking about a family and the functionality of a family, or we're talking about two individuals and their relationship, and that can be a mother and a child, or that can be two siblings, or they can, whatever, in any kind of relationship, you can have a relationship that you can trust with the freeway. You can have a relationship that you would only drive around the block,
right,
that you wouldn't take any further than the grocery store, or you can have a relationship that you would go coast to coast with.
Right.
So it's just like that. So I'm not saying something is not a relationship or it's not parenthood or it's
right.
not a family if it doesn't meet this criteria. What I'm saying is there's perfect and there's completely non-functional,
right,
and there's an entire universe of reality between those two.
And the thing is, like, you know, there are goals and aspirations that every parent, I want to raise my kid like this, and I want to always do this, and I want to make sure and do this.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want to do what my parents do this. With this. Yeah.
And the thing is, like, raising kids is, at some point, you're going to have not slept
mm-hmm.
for, like, 48 hours.
Yeah, if you're lucky.
And at some point, you're not going to have eaten all
yeah.
day.
Yeah.
And at some point, your kid is going to be teething, or mm-hmm. your kid is going to just colicky be in a bad mood.
Or earaches, or...
And you're going to do something on your list of, I'm never going to do that.
Yeah.
And that doesn't that doesn't make you a complete failure as a parent.
Yeah.
It makes you a human being.
Yeah, because take this back to the car metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
You have that car that you trust to go on a coast-to-coast 3,000-mile trip, and it can still have a flat tire.
Right.
And it's still a car.
Right.
And you just fix the tire and you move on.
Right.
You don't forever and ever hate the car because it got that flat tire once, or forever doubt the ability of the car because it got the flat tire.
Right.
You just say, wish that hadn't happened. You repair it the best you can, and you do what you got to do, and you go
right.
on. And that's picking up the pieces and keep moving is the difference of whether the thing gets crushed or whether the thing, you know, continues.
Right. You know, and you can even, oh no, I dinged the side of it. Well, mm-hmm. I guess it's not perfect anymore. I won't bother putting oil in it, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm going to switch to cheap gas and,
yeah,
you know.
Or I'm never going to wash it again
right.
because now it's dirty.
Just because it's scraped a little.
Mm-hmm.
Even if that's a permanent scrape.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that you can't still have a perfectly good functioning car.
Yeah.
You know.
So, let's take this back to actual children and real life people. So, you have this baby and it's born and you commit yourself that you're going to treat it like a human,
mm-hmm.
not as a toy, not as something you own, not as an object that you own, not as, you know, a trophy, not as a pet. Did I already say pet? Well, don't treat it like a pet.
Don't treat it like a pet.
I think I said trophy. But, you know, all these things are aspects of many of the things in modern society that we tend to try to, that society pushes us towards putting our child into one of those categories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want to use it to prove to our parents that we're good parents because, you know, now we're going to do all these things right.
Right.
Or we use it to show all of our friends, you know, that this or that. And rather than realizing that that child is another person,
right,
an entire human being with full functioning human rights. And some people don't believe they do. Some people say, no, it doesn't have human rights because it's not an adult. Well, now we're drawing magic lines. When does this age come about?
Right.
You know, well, the state wants to tell us that there's this series of ages. When they become 16, they have certain rights. When they become 18, they have certain rights. When they become 21, they have certain rights. When they become 65, they have certain rights.
Right.
That's just stupid.
Yeah.
That's not based on any kind of logic. That's not based on any kind of reality.
Yep.
That's how the state, that's central planning for you. That's
yeah.
what the state does, central planning. And that's an aspect of central planning. So, for example, there are 12-year-olds who are every bit responsible enough to to understand how to function in the capacity and safely drive a car.
Mm-hmm.
And there are 30-year-olds who should not be behind the wheel.
Oh, yeah.
And so when you have a child that's brand new, freshly born, there's no logical reason to deny that child any particular rights.
Now, you know, it doesn't have property rights in the sense that it can't own property, in that it can't understand, you know, how to maintain a homestead at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But it can have property rights in that it understands that this teddy bear is my teddy bear.
Yeah, or it has property rights in itself.
And right.
It, you know, it owns itself, it owns its own will, its own desires. So, you know, and property rights in a child develop, the understanding of the property rights develop really quickly in a little kid.
I kind of think of parenting as, warning, warning, bad Quaker geek alert, warning, warning. You know in Lord of the Rings how Denethor was the steward of Gondor?
Uh-huh.
He wasn't the king.
Right.
He didn't own Gondor.
No, he was just there to watch over it.
Yeah, to make sure that it functioned mm-hmm. until the king came back
right.
and took control of it.
Right.
I kind of feel that's the same way with parenting.
Kind of like a librarian and the books in the library.
Right.
The library, no matter how psychotic the old lady may be, doesn't actually own those books. We just lost our librarian audience.
Hi, librarians. Yeah, but, you know, it's your job to protect your child's property rights
mm-hmm.
and body rights and mm-hmm. sovereignty until such point as they can do it themselves,
mm-hmm.
you know.
I don't want to go in that direction. I started to go in into the direction of child labor and when a child actually can support themselves and have ownership of themselves. Well, let me just touch on this. My dad, I like to talk about my dad because he's extremely old right now. He's very elderly and he's can't do a lot of the things that he could do just a couple years ago. He's really, age has taken its toll on him, but his life is amazing. And, when he was really small, now we're talking like 3 and 4 years old,
mm-hmm.
they were very poor living in Appalachia, and instead of having wallpaper, like, you know, and they couldn't afford paint,
mm-hmm.
and they couldn't afford wallpaper, so what they would do is they would get discarded newspapers from the big city, and they would take the newspaper and make a slurry of flour and water. And sometimes some people would use flour and water and eggs. I don't know if they did in that case or not, but these are the common things that you used in those days. And you make this slurry, and you take the newspapers, and then you go along the walls inside your house, and you put these up, and that blocks, because in a clapboard house is built where just one board, you can't see my hands again, one horizontal board just lays right on top of the next horizontal board,
right.
and each one laps over each other by a half an inch or so, and this does a certain amount of job of keeping out the weather. But then on the interior of that lapboard house, what you do is you put on another series of boards on the inside, and then you slap on this layer of this flour water mixture, and then you slap on newspapers, and then more water mixture, and then flour water mixture, and then more newspapers, mm-hmm. and eventually you can seal that wall relatively good. And as the years go by, and the heat and cool, and the settling of the house, and it'll crack.
Mm-hmm.
So you keep, anytime there's a crack, you go back and you moisten it with the water flour slurry, and you put another newspaper there, or
right.
two, or three, or five, or whatever. So essentially you have a paper mache layer there to insulate, and
right.
that was very common in Appalachia back in the 1920s. So when my dad was young, that's the kind of walls that they had. And my dad was the oldest of his family, so his mother and father, they had worked hard and built a new cabin for them to live in.
Mm-hmm.
And it had its own, what they called the nursery, which was, it was a two-bedroom cabin. And they had one bedroom that was actually the living room, kitchen, and bedroom, and the other was the nursery mm-hmm. for the baby. And so in there, they thought it was cute. They put all funny papers, you know, mm-hmm. Comics, the newspaper comics mm-hmm. for the nursery. It's cute. You know, you're in Appalachia. It's 1923. Trust me, this is cute. So
this is decorating.
Yeah.
Interior design.
So as my father matured and he got to be around 2 or 3 years old, before they would go to bed at night, they would go in and sit with him and they would read him the funny papers off the walls. And by the time he was 4, he had listened and watched them reading the funny papers off the walls, and he had figured out how to read. So by the age of 4, my dad could read. Mm-hmm. Now, he didn't go to school, and they didn't actively teach him that.
Right.
He had an interest in it, so he picked up on it.
Right.
And so by the age of 4, he could read.
Right.
Now, he wasn't old enough for them to be allowed to let him go to school yet, because they had a one-room schoolhouse mm-hmm. that was down the ways a little. But he wasn't old enough, so he couldn't go down there until he got to be I think like 6 or something before you were allowed to go to the school in those days.
Right. Old enough to where you can sit still.
Yeah. I'm not exactly sure where I was headed with all this.
Labor laws and stuff.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly where. Thank you very much. See, that's why we work good as a team, and that's why I'm rambling and nonsensical when I do Bad Quaker Podcast all by myself. And I end up over here yelling about the Puritans. The Puritans are going to get us. Anyway, so my dad taught himself how to read by the time he was 4. Mm-hmm. By the time he got to school, and he was like 6 or whatever when he finally went to school, and now for the first time he had books, mm-hmm. and he just was fascinated by them. So he would just gobble them up. And he learned how to write, because he could read, but he couldn't write.
Right.
So he learned how to write, and he learned his numbers, and he learned all this stuff pretty much on his own. So by the time he was like, I don't know exactly, but like 8 or 9 or something like that, he had already gone through all the 8 grades that they had available at that school.
Right.
Because all the kids, the teacher couldn't take the time to work with each student in this one-room classroom, because there was like 40 kids in there.
Right.
Now, this is something against the general argument. Public schools, well, they have 25 kids, 30 kids in a schoolhouse, and this is thrown off. Well, there's some truth to this argument. But a lot of those one-room schoolhouses would have 30, 40 kids in there.
Right.
The difference is
they were all ages.
They were all, exactly. And so the kids that were 9... and the kids that were, you know, 6 would interact and help each other.
Right.
And this took the burden off the teacher. All the teacher really had to do was make sure nobody's hurting each other.
Right.
And then let nature take its course, and the kids teach the kids.
Yeah.
And kids learn at the rate that they need to learn at.
Yeah.
That's natural to them. That's a whole different topic right there. But anyway.
And I think we'll probably get into that at some point.
Yeah. So anyway, in my dad's case, by the time that he was, you know, like, I'm not sure exactly the years, but by the time he was like 8 or 9, he had already gone through all the classes, all the book work, and all the lessons, that they called them lessons, because right. you had the book and you would do lessons from the book. And he had done them all the way through the 8th grade, and there was nothing else he could learn from that school. Mm-hmm. When, at the time that they finally decided to let my dad go to high school, he went the first day. Now this is a big deal, because now you had to get on the bus and
right.
go into town, and it was like a half an hour ride into town. So he waited, he got on the bus, he rode the bus into town, he went the first day of high school, and he was a little kid. You know, most people when they go into high school, they're like, what, like 14 or something, 15? And he's like 9.
Wow. Yeah,
so,
like 15.
Yeah. So he shows up, he's like a 9-year-old kid at high school, and keeping in mind that he has graduated everything and he's ready to go, academically speaking, in. But the problem was, he got there and all the little 15-year-old girls thought he was just so cute because he's like a little baby. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, and plus he has this blonde, curly, fuzzy hair on top of his head, and he's just like this cute little thing. Mm-hmm. So they all made a big deal out of him and horribly embarrassed him, and he wouldn't go back again. Mm-hmm. And he went the first day to high school, and he wouldn't go back after that. So he hung around the farm, It was, I think, either that year or the next year that his father, my grandfather, bought the farm's first vehicle, their first motor vehicle. It was a Ford Model T in the truck series, mm-hmm. Like a pickup truck, but it was a Model T.
Right.
And it was not purchased to drive around.
Right.
It was purchased specifically for the farm. And so then my grandfather went away to work on the railroad. He worked on the railroad several days a week. Well, he went away to work on the railroad, and my dad couldn't figure out what made this machine work. So he disassembled the engine one day to see how the machine worked. Now, we're talking...
Like you do.
He was like 10 or 11 at the time when he disassembled the engine. Yeah, like you do. So what I'm bringing this up for is because if you have a child... My grandparents, amazing that they were...
Mm-hmm.
They just let him develop as he wanted to.
Right.
And they let him have his way. And by the time that he was 13 years old, he had a job and was making his own living.
Right.
He actually moved out and went to work on a coal-fired riverboat and was in the belly of the riverboat shoveling coal and became a steam engineer
mm-hmm.
on the riverboat. When most kids are just beginning to go to high school.
Yeah.
And that's because he was allowed to blossom. Now, you might make the argument, well, he was unusual. And yes, he was very bright and all that. But you don't know what the potential of a kid is.
Right.
So anyway,
You know, and that's the thing, especially with child labor laws, is he wasn't repressed. He wasn't like forced to
right.
do that.
Right.
He just
Well,
he could.
Yeah. And when he was like, you know, at 14, he's on the riverboat. He's making a living. But it's the Depression.
Right.
And the choice is, you know, work for a living or go hungry.
Right.
And so it was a good thing that he could do that. A lot of kids were going hungry.
Yeah.
So he had a place to sleep, he had food,
mm-hmm.
he could stay healthy, and he was not being robbed in any way or harmed by the fact that, you know, he's doing a job he can do.
Right.
You're shoveling coal into the mouth of this thing. Don't touch it, it'll burn you. How difficult
yeah.
is that?
You know, I'm pretty sure even like a 13-year-old kid can manage that.
So,
anyway,
that rant totally was not planned, and that was not what we were going to talk about today.
That's pretty typical for a BadQuaker.com podcast.
Yeah, that's exactly how we do things around here. It's how we roll, as the kids say.
But the idea is, as a child,
mm-hmm.
If you want your child to respect property rights, you have to respect their property rights.
Exactly.
You know, and for me personally, I feel like the biggest property right that you have is yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's number one. If you don't have control over your own body, you don't have, you have nothing.
You have no property rights.
Right. You know, and so I get really irritated. There's a lot of people, especially with little girls, you know, they pierce their ears when they're a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, isn't that cute? Well, she'll want it when she gets older and it'll be easier to clean it now.
But
well,
you're making that decision.
What if she doesn't want
her?
It when she's older?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Or what if she wanted something else? Or, you know, that's not your body to decide that. That's not your decision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're violating her property rights by doing that.
Right.
You know?
By you deciding that you're going to alter her physical body,
mm-hmm.
you're going to use violence, you're going to aggress on her.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, puncture her skin. Whether you think she'll want it in 10 years is not the point.
Right.
The fact is that you just made that decision for her. You showed that you own her body and she does not.
Which is actually where piercings originally came from.
Yes.
A way to show ownership.
Yes, piercing, much like tattooing, unfortunately, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, all you radical kids out there with your crazy tattoos, but in mostly tattoos were to show tribal allegiance mm-hmm. and to show slave ownership.
And As a person, it's okay to get a tattoo and say, you know, see, I own my body. I can make a decision to put art on my body if I want.
Exactly.
But if you're doing it forcibly to somebody else, it's showing that you own them now, and that they have no property rights.
Let's compare a piercing, taking a little six-month-old baby or a little two-year-old baby, taking that little girl down to your local mall and having her ears pierced, would you get her a tattoo?
No. So, no, who, of course not.
No one would make that argument that that would be a legitimate thing to do. But yet, what you're doing is you're doing body modification. Mm-hmm. You're doing body modification by piercing that person's body.
And, you know, I can testify to this 100%. It doesn't matter of the fact that a piercing will close.
Right.
You're going to have a scar.
Yeah, and besides that, to make the argument that, oh, well, it'll heal back, well, then great, I can just go around randomly punching people and it's okay because it'll heal back.
Right?
See, that's an invalid argument. So the fact is, if you're doing body modification to a child, you're violating that child's property. You're violating their civil rights. You're violating their property in doing that. You're disrespecting their right to own their own body. And this goes, you know, now we're making ridiculous arguments. Like, oh, well, if you're making the argument of tattooing a child, that's a ridiculous argument. It is, exactly. But that's how you show how ridiculous something else is.
Yeah.
If it's ridiculous to tattoo the child, it's also ridiculous to pierce their ears.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's take a more controversial topic, and let's just go ahead and just really irritate some people, because if BadQuaker.com is not here to irritate anybody, what are we really good for?
If we dance around issues and don't really say what's on our mind, then we're really not bad Quakers, are we?
We're more like moderate Quakers.
I don't want to offend anyone.
So now, if we agree that to take a little girl and give her a nice big butterfly tattoo across her forehead, if we can agree that that's inappropriate, mm-hmm. it's brutal, that it's a violation of her rights, if we can agree to that, and if we can see that there's a connection between tattooing a little girl and driving a hole, driving a spike through her ears against her will,
mm-hmm.
if we can understand that that has a link, and we can begin to see the moral link there, then we can also go to something that is culturally, in the Western societies, we reject female circumcision mm-hmm. as being brutal, as being barbaric.
We don't
barbaric.
Even call it circumcision.
No, we call it mutilation, yeah. and we have names like that for it. Because it is.
It is.
And yet...
And it doesn't matter, you know, with female circumcision, people say, oh, well, you know, we do it for religious reasons. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, you know, the purpose
people
doesn't matter.
Still, you know, in Western society, people have said, even if you do this for religious reasons, it is still a violation of that person's human rights.
Well, let's take it back to the other thing. If I punch you in the nose for religious reasons, is this okay now?
Right.
Is that fine?
If I hold you down and tattoo a swastika on your forehead because it's my religion.
Or this to go the other way. If we hold you down and tattoo a number and assign you a number and tattoo that across your arm,
mm-hmm.
is that okay because it's our religion? Of course not.
No. It's a human rights violation.
Right. So we all agree that if you're going to take a little girl and you're going to mutilate her in that fashion, whether we're talking any level of mutilation.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to accept that there are degrees of mutilation that are okay?
Yeah.
So you can't circumcise her. You can't tattoo a butterfly across her forehead. You can't tattoo a swastika on her arm. But you can poke a hole through her ear.
Right.
And that's all right. We're okay with that.
it's degrees of evil.
So now that we have laid this foundational principle of leaving a person alone and not attacking a person mm-hmm. and not aggressing on another person's body, then what about male circumcision?
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's something where people get all up in arms. Oh, well, you know, and they try to hold up these, well, it's for medical reasons. And
well, that's a lie.
And it's like, no, it's not. That's absolutely a lie. You know, every single generation... Mm-hmm. Since circumcision for boys has become popular in the United States, there has been a medical reason for it.
Mm.
That the next generation rejects as silly,
yeah,
and replaces it with their own medical reason. Right now it's, oh, well, it helps prevent HIV. That's ridiculous. It's stupid. No, it doesn't. There's no way it can. That is an invalid argument.
If that's the valid argument to circumcise little boys, little babies, then what was the argument in 1970 when there was no HIV?
Right.
And what was the argument in 1940?
Right.
Because the argument in 1945 for a lot of people, and this is not repeated nowadays.
Oh, no.
But the argument in 1945 was that if the evil Nazis ever gain power again, they won't know who Jews are.
Right.
So we need to circumcise as many as possible. Because in the military, American prisoners were segregated according to who was circumcised and who wasn't. Mm-hmm. And so there was this fear that this would happen in another generation. But after a very short period of time, that was an invalid argument. And so who makes that argument now?
And, you know, you can get even nastier.
Go back to people like Kellogg.
Oh, man, there was a psychopath if ever there was one. Kellogg, now, I should specify, we're not talking about the Kellogg who founded Kellogg's, like Kellogg's Corn Flakes. That was Kellogg's brother. Corn Flakes.
Or was it the Post brother? Was there more than one Post, or was there more than one Kellogg?
I don't remember.
Anyway, whoever was named Kellogg, who was the nut,
running the sanitarium. Metallica moment there. He was that one actually running that. He was the nutcase Puritan vegetarian whack job.
Yeah.
Who wrote down specific that you should circumcise a boy and a girl. He was pro-girl female circumcision as well. Specifically in the most brutal, painful way possible. So that later on, they could be Puritan.
Because the whole thing was to imprint into their mind how sinful that was.
Yeah.
This goofy idea, all right, we got to wrap it up here, but just let me just touch this really quick, because this goes back to idiotic myths about the Garden of Eden.
Ugh.
That somehow the forbidden fruit was the physical relation between a male and a female. Now, you really think... What kind of a god would create humans and male and female and put them together and say, okay, go and be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, except...
It was the first commandment to humans.
Number one. Yes.
You get made, the first thing that God tells you...
Go make babies. Go do that.
Go be fruitful. That doesn't mean grow bananas. We're not talking about a fruit pie.
So what kind of a twisted god would tell you to go and be fruitful and then punish you for doing it?
Yeah.
So clearly, the tree of good and evil had nothing to do with a physical relationship between male and female.
Yeah.
That is an absolute lie that's been dumped on us by the stinking, filthy Puritans that
Anyway, so, that was today's podcast. It was all about protecting the property and body rights of infants.
And a long rambling rant about my dad.
Right. So stay tuned. We'll talk about...
We'll try to get into toddler age and all the fun of dealing with a toddler. Oh, boy!
And how to instill in them... a respect of other people's property rights.
Absolutely. And what comes natural to a child in that age, what they know to be property rights all on their own, and how we can help them to understand what they're going through.
And maybe we'll touch on education, too.
Yes. Thank you very much for listening to us today, folks. BadQuaker.com.
And that was the first in our series of Raising a Nonviolent Family. Be sure and check back again with BadQuaker.com for more in this series, and as always, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to BadQuaker.com, and thank you for listening.